is probably the first academic lecture you're going to have. So I'll be talking about complex analysis, and so I'm not a mathematician. So the subject matters, the topics in complex analysis that I'll be covering are the ones that I think that you guys should need for the coming year. I cannot guarantee it because the lectures, the subjects are quite wide. Also, it's only four lectures. I'll probably have material for three lectures, and I think I will just run over and then probably fill up the fourth lecture. So the list of topics that I'm going to cover is a very quick overview of the basics of complex numbers. So basics of complex numbers. And the complex plane, which is also sometimes, depending on how smart you want to sound, people call it the Argand vessel plane. So if you look at Roger Penrose's book, that Emperor's New Mind, he calls it the Argand plane. But if you look at his new book, The Road to Reality, he calls it the vessel plane, because in between he discovered that there was somebody, Vessel had introduced the idea of the complex plane even before Argand. So I'm just following Roger Penrose here. And then, so basically what this is just a name. What it is that it gives a geometric interpretation to complex numbers. And then I'll also be, after that, just mention briefly a very useful theorem, De Moivre theorem. Sorry, my French is not what it used to be. And then we'll go to the realm of functions of complex variables. And the useful class of functions that we are going to consider are holomorphic functions. They're also sometimes known as analytic. And I think there's another name for them, right? Do you know? Anyway, so analytic functions. Okay. And then useful in physics is the connection to harmonic functions. So harmonic functions are functions which are basically solutions to Laplace's equations. And if you have a holomorphic function, it turns out that you get harmonic functions for free. And as you may know, that Laplace's equation crops up in a lot of different branches of physics, starting from electrostatics to fluids, as well as heat conduction, even in string theory, even you do an analytic continuation to a Euclidean spacetime. So after that, holomorphic functions fail to be, well, they have, so holomorphic functions are in some sense well-behaved complex functions, but we are not really, it turns out that functions which are kind of singular at various isolated points on the complex plane, they're also very interesting. So we'll look at the isolated singularities Oh, by the way, when we study holomorphic analytic functions, I'll mention Taylor's theorem. And when these complex functions have isolated singularities, there's another series which is relevant, and that goes by the name of Laurent series. And then, probably the most important result that we are going to discuss is the various form of Cauchy's theorem. And then, Cauchy's theorem is very easy to state, but it's extremely, extremely useful in evaluating lots of different kinds of integrals. So there'll be applications of Cauchy's theorems, applications in, say, in evaluating integrals. And if I have time, we'll discuss something known as analytic continuation. So, needless to say that you can interrupt me anytime you want with questions. Whether I'll be able to answer your question is an entirely different thing. So, somewhere in there, we'll do branch cuts and things like that. Okay? So I'm not gonna spend too much time on this because I'm assuming that most of you have seen this, but I'm going to spend some time on this because in my experience the last 2 years, there will always be a few students for whom this is actually not extremely new, but newish. So, and it's good to start slowly. Okay, so any questions so far? No fancy theorems will be covered. What was the name of the book that we all made you that sent you? Goldbart something something. Yeah. So for fancy theorems, you can go to that book. Okay. So there will be some so the tutorials. So the basics of complex numbers, so there'll be a tutorial today in the afternoon. So I'm not going to cover the basics of complex numbers in the tutorial. Now, at some point, I think last month or earlier this month, I sent you an email with a list of exercises. And that actually has most of what you need from the basics of complex numbers. So if you want to review the basics of complex numbers, I suggest that you go through that. In the tutorial today, we'll do some fun stuff like what is a Riemann sphere and things like that. Not that the basics are not fun. So, okay, haha, I get to use this blackboard. Okay, a little bit of history. So, apparently, this Italian guy, Girolamo Cardano, sorry, came across, proposed the idea of square root of a negative number in 1545 because he was solving the quadratic equation for this range of parameters. And as you know that you need to take the but he kind of didn't really take the idea very seriously. So that's how complex numbers arose, is because you needed to solve the quadratic equation. Now, the natural question that might arise in your mind is that, what about solving equations, polynomial equations of higher order? Do you need, say, some other fancy number, say, for to solve the cubic equations and stuff like that? And it turns out, no, complex numbers are enough. You guys all know this, right? Okay. Anyway, but I have to walk, like, every like course has to have a little bit of a waffle at the beginning, right? So I'm just doing that little waffle. So now complex numbers over the last few centuries have become an integral part of mathematics. And in the 20th century, it has become an integral part of physics. You can't do quantum mechanics without complex numbers. Because you're at Perimeter Institute, you will hear talks on quantum mechanics over the real numbers. You will hear talks about quantum mechanics over quaternions. So people do work on this kind of stuff, but apparently our universe doesn't care about these other types of quantum mechanics. It cares about quantum mechanics over the complex numbers. And then the relativistic generalization of quantum mechanics, which is known as quantum field theory, you will see that, again, complex numbers are kind of fundamental in understanding the quantum, you know, the structure of quantum field theory. And then there are more exotic applications of quantum, of complex numbers to physics. For example, Penrose's twister theory. You know, complex numbers play a very an essential role in the subject. And in recent years, these two things, there have been a big, big push to kind of merge these two things. And hopefully in December, Nima Arkani-Hamed will tell you more about this. And this is actually quite a big topic of research here at PI. Then string theory. Doesn't really work unless there are complex numbers. Well, it's kind of almost like a subset of these things. In string theory, not only do we have complex number playing an essential role, but we have something called a complex geometry. So there's a generalization of the notion of geometry where into two these new spaces called complex manifolds. And string theory actually lives on these, you know, the world sheet of a string as it sweeps out, you know, as it moves through space-time, that turns out to be essentially to have, you know, a complex manifold. So, and I'm not an expert on this, but I hear that the fundamental variable in loop quantum gravity is actually a complex quantity as well. So anyway, that's an incomplete list of things that should motivate you to think of complex numbers more seriously. And I have waffled for 15 minutes. Okay, so so the absolute basics. So we have the unit imaginary number, which is I is this thing, and it has the property, right? And so a complex number is the pair of real numbers A and B. And it's this pair, you know, subject to this condition. Now, the set of complex numbers form a commutative, associative division algebra. So basically, all the usual notions of addition, multiplication, division, if you extend them to the complex, to the complex numbers, you know, taking into account this rule, you basically get an algebra which in on which division, a commutative associative algebra on which division is defined. So so you know, addition is pretty straightforward. So if you have a complex number, if you have two complex numbers, then you basically add these two guys. This is great. This is like being back in grade school, right? So, and then the multiplication of two complex numbers is so the idea is that whatever operation you do, you want to write the final result in this form, where these two guys, A and B, are real. And as you can see, you can do that by multiplication. So the idea is that, you know, you don't really go out of the set. And then this is a little bit more complicated, like division. So I'll just, this is the last thing I'll do from these basic things, which is very simple, from the in explicitly. So we have, so to write this in this form, we do what is known, we rationalize this. So we multiply both the numerator and the denominator with this weird combination, which is x2 minus I of y2, x2 minus I of y2. And then if you follow through the algebra, you get over here x1, x2 plus y1, y2, x2 squared, y2 squared plus I, y1, x2 minus y2, x1, x2 squared plus y2 squared. So as you can see, this is also in this form. So parenthetically, well, I mean, this is a good place for me to define the complex conjugation of a number. So for example, what we did that if this is a complex number, say z2 is x2 plus I of y2, then we can define an operation called the complex conjugate, which I denote by z bar, where I replace the I by minus I. So another common notation for complex conjugation is star. So, but I'll be sticking to Z bar. So so you can verify that, well, it's obvious that if you complex conjugate twice, you get the original number back, and that if you complex conjugate the multiple of Z1, well, of Z2, then it's the same as first taking the complex conjugate of those two things and multiplying. Now, complex numbers, the set of complex number is not an ordered set, right? I mean, real numbers, there's, given two real numbers, there's a notion of which one is bigger and which one is smaller, or if they're equal. But for complex numbers, that's not a, it's not an ordered set, right? So for example, if you have, say, So if you have, say, two numbers, say 1 plus I, another, say, 1 minus I, then, which one is bigger, right? A natural way of introducing an ordering on the complex, on the set of complex number is known as the modulus. Now, this makes it a partially ordered set. So, and the modulus of a complex number is defined as square root of z times z bar. And in terms of the real x and y, this is kind of this is, I mean, this is suggestive of Pythagoras. So, there's a geometric notion kind of knocking about there. So this is a real, so this is real and positive, right? Now, if we apply this modulus to these two numbers, we find that both of them have the same modulus, which is square root of 2, right? So they don't really resolve, which one. So both of these numbers are of the same size with respect to this modulus. Whereas, if you had these two numbers, then this one, the modulus of this would be, what is it? Right? So square root of 5, which is bigger than this thing, right? So I'm not sure, but is this what is called a partially ordered set? Poset? I always thought the name Poset was funny. Anyway, sorry. So anyway, so as I was saying, that there's a geometrical notion kind of sticking, knocking about there. So let's delve into that. Sorry, I'm just, there's not enough space for me for my coffee and my paper here. So, okay. Yeah, exactly. So, front. I could get used to this. Okay, so the geometry of complex numbers, the so-called Argand-Wessel plane. So the idea is that you already know of the geometric interpretation of the real numbers as living on a line. So this is the real axis, also known as x. And this is the imaginary axis. Also known as y, or should we call it something else? Anyway, y, yeah. So y. And then, so the complex number that I've written over here, say, well, let's take a sum of, say, this guy, 1 plus I. So what it means that you go one distance, one along the real axis, and then a distance I along the imaginary axis. So this point is 1 plus I. So you can, it's natural to think of a complex number as a vector from the origin. And this plane is known as the Argand-Wessel plane, also known as C. Then, obviously the addition of complex numbers kind of has an obvious geometric interpretation. Okay, maybe I should start not right over there. Yeah, okay. So that means I'll have to use this more often. Oh, this is a bug. This doesn't go up, although it's supposed to. Yeah. So the addition of two complex numbers, suppose we have a complex number here, which is Z1, and some here Z2, then basically, you know, the parallelogram rule of vector addition. Sorry, I'm terrible at drawing parallel lines. So if this is Z1 and this is Z2, then this is Z1 plus Z2. Oops. Now this is obvious. However, the next one is not so obvious, which is the geometric interpretation of Z1 times Z2. And I'll just draw it here. So suppose we have a number Z1, another number say Z2, then to find the geometric interpretation of Z1 times Z2, what we do is that we first figure out what 1 is and form a triangle with Z1, the origin, and 1, and then form a similar triangle with Z2 and when we form a similar triangle, this point is Z1 times Z2. So these two triangles are similar. And that's the interpretation of multiplication of complex numbers. And you should, when you have more time, you should actually work that out. So this is really what makes complex numbers so much fun. You know, that's not, you don't get this from vectors, you know, usual two-dimensional vectors, unless you have that little funny rule, I squared is minus 1. What I like most about complex numbers, so it's my personal preference, is that when you multiply a number by I, it rotates that number by 90 degrees counterclockwise. So according to that geometric, if you take 1, if you multiply 1 by I, you come to this point. So you are rotating by 90 degrees counterclockwise. Now, if you multiply I by I, you get minus 1. So you're rotating by another 90 degrees to minus 1. And then you multiply again by I, and you rotate, and you go to minus I, and so on. So it's kind of nature's merry-go-round. Now, it begs the question whether, whether you can rotate by an arbitrary angle, right? Is there an operation in complex numbers such that can I rotate 1 not by 90 degrees but by 24.5? Yes, we can. But before we do that, let me introduce a different parametrization of complex numbers. So you see, the bug is that board doesn't come down when you're going this way, but it comes down when you're going this way on this control panel. So it should come down now. Okay, so the parametrization of complex numbers that brings out the power and the beauty of complex number is the polar representation. So what we're doing is we're just going to polar coordinates on the complex plane. So this is Z, and R is basically the length of the complex number, and this is theta. So this is X, this is Y. So it should be obvious to you that R is the modulus of the complex number. So what Euler found, okay, the other thing is that theta is called the argument of the complex number, or the arg of Z. This arg has nothing to do with argand. It's argument. So what Euler found was that, you know, using the series expansion of the trigonometric, or Maclaurin expansion, I guess they're called, of the cosine of the circular functions, and using the fact that I squared is minus 1, you can rewrite these two series, rearrange the terms one by one, and you can do that because both of the series converge, so you can do an infinite number reshuffling. And write this as R e to the power I of theta, where this is a formal series, right? So e to the power I theta goes from 0 to infinity I theta to the power n factorial n. And Euler found this relationship. And then he wrote down his very famous formula that, what was it? Minus 1 is equal to e to the power I pi, right? So this is so beautiful that Euler used it as an argument for the existence of God. Well, the story is that, you know, Denis Diderot, the French encyclopedist and the novelist, he was famous as an atheist. I think he was more intelligent than Richard Dawkins, but anyway. So he was visiting, and Euler was the court mathematician to Catherine the Great's, to Catherine the Great. And Diderot was visiting Catherine the Great, and Catherine the Great wanted Euler to find a way of insulting Diderot. And Euler thought that, oh, maybe that guy doesn't know enough about mathematics. So, you know, and he said, you know, here's a simple proof of God's existence, that e to the power I pi is equal to minus 1, and therefore God exists.
Right, yeah.
It's on the other side, right? Yeah, so, yeah, this is probably more dramatic, right? Yes, it's like, oh my God. Yeah, so I have read a little bit about this, the history of this, and apparently, because I like Diderot a lot, and I didn't like that he got insulted, and he's one of my favorite novelists. So it turns out that it's actually apocryphal, but it's a fun story nonetheless, you know. So... And this incidentally also answers the question that I asked earlier, whether, you know, there you can actually rotate. I guess I didn't have to do that. I could have started in the bottom, right? So it answers the questions I asked earlier, whether you can rotate by an arbitrary angle. Yes, you just multiply by e to the power I theta. So you can also think of multiplication by complex number as an operation which, you know, rotates a point, the points on the complex plane to other points. Okay. What time is it? We need a clock in this room. Oh dear. Okay. Okay, so on to more interesting things. So now the polar representation of complex numbers bring out an interesting aspect so suppose that you have a number like this, some r times I theta plus 2 pi n. Now, given a z, given a complex number on the complex plane, this does not, so where n is an integer, this does not determine what n is uniquely. N can be any integer. So what we call is the value of theta for which n is zero. So the value of theta for which, value of theta for which n is zero, we call it the principal value of an argument. So we call that the principal value of an argument. So the thing is that for a given complex number, there is the argument, there's a degeneracy in the argument. And one of those values, we call it the principal value. So for example, if we take the imaginary number, pure imaginary number I, then this can be written as e to the power I pi by 2, e to the power I 5 pi by 2, stuff like that. But the principal value of the argument is pi by 2. So given the polar form of the complex number, it becomes obvious this theorem called the de Moivre's theorem, that becomes obvious. So if you raise this particular combination to some power alpha, where alpha is a real number, right? So this becomes obvious, because the left-hand side is nothing but e to the power I of theta to the power 2 alpha, and the right-hand side is just this thing. So remember that complex numbers really arose from considering the square root. So you might think that taking the root of a complex number is something that is interesting. And everything in this subject is interesting because of the rich geometric, interpretation. And so the next thing that I want to talk about is taking the root of a complex number. Yes. Yes. You mean what would happen if alpha were not real, if this would still hold? Let's see. So if alpha wasn't real, so I can write e to the power I alpha as say beta plus I gamma, and then e to the power I beta theta minus theta of gamma, right? And then this is e to the power minus theta gamma. And then this is e to the power I beta of theta. So then this is e to the power minus theta of this. And this thing is cosine of beta plus I sine of beta theta, right? So can you rewrite this in terms of alpha? No, you can't.
So.
Right, this guy, right? Yeah. And then, so do you get this? You probably should, right? Because then you'd use those, right. Right, okay, yeah, so. So after that. Right, I see. So you write this as e to the power I beta theta plus e to the minus I beta of theta, and divided by 2 plus 2i e to the power I beta theta minus I over here?
Yeah, but you had I.
Oh, you're right, yeah, so, sorry. So, right. So, e to the power, right. So this cancels this, right? This cancels this, right? And then we have this guy multiplying, and this this plus this is 2, that 2 can, so we have, oh, did I? Okay. Right. Okay. And okay, so you have your answer. Yeah. Okay, so so we have a root of a complex number, which is say omega is some given complex number, and we want to find what z is. So if you do that, then it's this is kind of an application of de Moivre's theorem. So you write in this whole business of the ambiguity in the argument. So if you write omega as say R e to the power I, some principal value, I'm not going to use the P, 2 pi, say K, where K is an integer, then the Z is given by R to the power, the 1 over N, e to the power I, theta by n plus 2 pi k by n, where, so we see that for k going from 0 to dot dot n minus 1, we get n distinct values, n distinct values of z. Right? And there is actually a geometric interpretation for this. And what it does is that these values of z form a, the vertices of a regular polygon. Something like this. And this is basically the distance from here to here is, and this angle is theta by n. And so for example, we can ask, what is the cube root of unity? So if you take the number 1 and you say, what is the cube root of number 1? Turns out that the solution to this are 1 e to the power 2 pi by 3 e to the power 4 pi by 3. Dang it. Yes, I missed this in my notes. I'm just reading out from my notes. I shouldn't. So if you call this particular root, say, omega, then you can very easily show 1 plus omega squared is 0. Now, you can do all kinds of manipulations. You can actually show this algebraically, but it's much easier to show this geometrically because you know that this is 1, and at 120 degrees, there's going to be another root, which is omega. And then at 120 degrees, there's going to be another root, which is omega squared. And they form the vertices of a equilateral triangle. And therefore, they add up to 0. The vectors add up to 0. So geometrically, the geometry of the whole thing just kind of, you know, opens up a lot of interesting ways of doing proofs in complex numbers. So the other thing that, you know, we can ask, so what is the inverse of the exponential? So we can now take the exponential of this function, right? E to the power iz. And then we can say, well, z is x plus iy. And then we can write ex as iy. So now you can ask, what's the inverse of this? What is the logarithm of z? So to see what the logarithm of z is, let's rewrite z. So z in terms of e to the power I theta, then the log of z is so what is the argument of z? It's theta. Now remember that the argument of z is has multiple values. It's an infinite number of values, right? It's a degenerate is the word that I use, but that's not the technically correct word. So so the log function is a multi-valued function. And one runs across this sort of multi-valued functions in complex numbers quite a lot. Another example is the square root of z. And again, what is z? Z is, so this means e to the power I of theta by 2. Now, if you go around the complex plane, around a circle once, so suppose you start here and you go around once, this function doesn't come back to its original value. You have to go around twice for it to come back to its original value. So such functions are not continuous, you know? But it would be nice for these sort of everyday kind of functions to be well-defined on the complex plane. So points such as this, so this, in this case, it's the origin, the zero, this is a, when I write 0, I mean 0 plus I0, which is 0, right? so these points, around which you draw a loop and you go around the loop once and you don't come back to the same value of the function, such points are known as branch points. And they're very interesting. So, so what you can now do is that you can, so when you encounter branch points, you can introduce a clever trick known as branch cuts to make these functions well-defined. Sorry, this is, my picture is in another file. I was panicking so much that I went faster than I thought I would. So, the aim is to modify the whole geometric picture we have in such a way that functions such as the log function or the square root of z are now well-defined functions. So let's look at the square root of z function. So what we do is that we say that starting from the branch point, this is a complex plane. So starting from the branch point, we introduce a line which we call the branch cut. So this is called the branch cut. And this branch cut goes off to infinity. Now you might say, how did I pick what direction the branch cut should go in? It'll turn out that this doesn't matter as long as it goes off to infinity in this case. And then, so we started at this point, right? So what we are going to say is that when we travel in this way and meet the branch cut, so we are going to introduce another copy of the same complex plane with another branch cut. When we hit the branch cut, we emerge on this other copy of the complex plane. And then we go around. And so when we return to this point, we are not on the same complex plane. We are on a separate, sheet of the complex plane. And then when we again come back to this branch cut, we now emerge on this original complex plane, and then we go back like this. So let me use some colors to show what I mean. So you come over here and you meet this branch cut, and you come to the violet side of the branch cut. Then you emerge over here. So what I'm doing, this color coding, means that I am identifying this line with that line, with those points. And so then you go around, and then you come to this side of the branch cut on the sheet below, and you come to the green side, to this green line, and emerge on this green line over here. So this is an example of what is known as a two-sheeted Riemann surface. So that's a bit of a mouthful, so let me write that down. So this is like a two-sheeted Riemann surface. So we are extending for these kind of functions the complex plane in this interesting way, and thereby making this function well-defined. So this function is actually well-defined on a two-sheeted Riemann surface. Now, can somebody tell me how many sheets we will need to make this function well-defined? Infinite, right? So it's like an infinite staircase. So stairway to heaven. Right. So I just kind of want to end with a question. So let me see if I can find that example. I'm all confused now, which button to press. Okay. All right, so. So you can show that, and I'll talk about this next time, like the inverse of a sine function is given by this formula. It's a log of I of z plus square root of 1 minus z squared. So I have a few questions. Where is the branch point for this function? And how many sheets do you need for this function? Okay, so how to think about this? So the log would kind of suggest that maybe we need an infinite number of sheets, right? But if you remember for the log function, the branch point is at the origin. So the argument of this has to go to zero for the infinite number of sheets to be relevant. So if you now think of this, if you set this to zero, you get 0 = 1, you get a contradiction. So the argument of this log function actually never goes to zero. So what, you know, so you do have a branch point here, but the branch point is relevant to this part of your function, right? So it's actually, so how many sheets would we have for a square root of a function? It will be 2, but where will it be actually located, right? At plus and minus 1, z equals 2, plus 1 and minus 1. Now, so if you draw the complex plane, so it's at plus 1 and minus 1, and this is the real line. Now, you actually have a choice of having the branch cut go between these two points, or you have a choice of having the branch cut go off to infinity. Now, it's your choice, and it's usual to choose the one, because, you know, this is a function which is quite well defined on the interval minus 1 to plus 3. This is very unorthodox. Minus 1 to plus 1, right? As a real function, it's well defined. That's what we're used to. So we usually don't want to introduce a branch cut on this bit. So it's more usual to choose the branch cut going from minus 1 to infinity and plus 1 to infinity. And I think I'm out of time. Let me see if I have 1 minute. I have 1 minute, so I will tell you about something. So you've done. So for complex functions, you can actually explore their behavior at infinity. The infinity, that's another amazing thing about complex numbers, is that it makes the point at infinity a completely regular point. And the way to see how a point behaves at infinity is to, you know, introduce a new variable which maps infinity to a finite point, in this case, to the origin, right? Then this function is basically becomes nothing but 1 over square root of omega. And then you can ask, how does this function behave at omega equals to 0? Which would be asking, how does this function behave at z equals to infinity? And you can see that this function also has a branch cut at omega equals to 0, right? And therefore, this function has a branch cut at infinity, a branch point at infinity. And this, branch cut that you were wondering about, where does it go off to? It goes off to infinity to join up with that point. And the fact that the point at infinity is nothing special is You know, to appreciate that point, we need to understand what is a Riemann sphere. And today in our tutorial, we'll actually see how to construct the Riemann sphere. Okay, thank you.